that it cannot make concessions because it is now encircled by more hostile neighbors. In the meantime, speaking of a hostile neighbor, it was 1 week ago, as I recall, yes, Sunday, February 13th, Muammar Gaddafi made a speech. He said, "This is a time of popular revolutions." He accused Western powers of being enemies of Islam, and he urged the entire Middle East to revolt against Israel by massing peacefully on the borders of Israel until it gives in to their demands, he said. Oh, you mean the same thing that he urged to be done against Israel now is being done against him and about to take him out? Maybe there still is a God in heaven. Maybe God doesn't take kindly to leaders such as Muammar Gaddafi, who in their arrogance and their pride come against the apple of his eye, Israel. We don't have time to go into it in detail, so I'll share just some preliminary thoughts with you concerning the power play that is taking place and has been taking place for probably well over 1,000 years. It's a power play between Turkey and Iran. Turkey's bid to trump Iran, as a matter of fact. An article came out in World Affairs, a very, very detailed article. Fascinating. Showing us the history of these two countries, Iran and Turkey. Remember, Iran was Persia until the early 1900s. Persia. So it's Turkey's bid to trump Persia. Persia, recall, was one of the great world leaders. Daniel talked about, did I say Turkey? I meant Persia. Persia was one of those great world leaders, the Medo-Persians. Daniel talked about Persia and Babylon. And for well over 1,000 years, there has been a battle, a seesaw battle between Turkey and Persia. Turkey and Persia, both Muslim. But Turkey is not Arab, and neither is Iran. Iranians are Persians, and Turkey is made up of Turks, none of which are Arabs. It's a fascinating picture because these two non-Arab countries are seeking to dominate the entire Islamic world. And a major part of the geopolitical moves that are taking place right now, unbeknownst to the media and even our own government, are being motivated by these two countries' efforts to dominate the entire Islamic world, and having dominated the entire Islamic world, to dominate the entire world. Well, friends, God is still on the throne. Aren't you glad? Put your trust in Him. I really want to urge you again to get a copy of that book, Seduction of the Saints, Staying Pure in a World of Deception. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries. It's $17, $18 rather. Give us a call, 1-800-SAVE-USA, and I want to urge you to become a partner with us. Day after day, we're preparing the way of the Lord for history's final hour. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Chrismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the...
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful, picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be the views, well, for the next hour of John Loftus, and we carry his book, America's Secret War Against the Jews. In fact, we're moving a fair number of those. But John has written several other books. One is The Secret War Against the Jews. The other is The Unholy Trinity. And I thought we're going to be carrying both of those books as well. So I thought perhaps John would be willing to tell us a little bit more about the secret war against the Jews. Now, of course, most people believe that America is the greatest ally of Israel, and certainly that the Zionists control Washington, D.C., which, of course, is rather ridiculous because we do so many things that are harmful to Israel. For instance, $150 million to train and arm the Palestinian Liberation Army, military, so they can, and I fear one day they'll be used against the Jews, but so much of what's going on really doesn't make sense unless you look behind the scenes. Certainly Israel is forced, when we give her money, to use that money to buy American arms. She can't develop her own industry as much as she'd like to. And most of the money that we give Israel is spent in American corporations on American weapons. And there seem to be people within Washington, D.C. intent upon manipulating the Israeli government. But I want to get John's views. John, what is the secret war against the Jews?
You know, it's a funny kind of thing. I went to Israel once and said I wanted to have this idea. I wanted to interview everyone in Western intelligence and have them tell me all the dirty tricks and covert operations that we ever pulled against the state of Israel. And I'm not Jewish. I'm Irish Catholic. When I told this book concept to the Israelis, they almost had a heart attack. They said, oh, no, don't do that. You can't write that story. We want to keep good relations with America. And I said, look, I'm going to submit my book for clearance to the CIA, and they'll vet it with whatever governments they want to. But this is coming from me, a non-Jew, telling the real history of what we did to Israel. And they tried and talked me out of it. They offered me, some inside access to Israeli nuclear secrets. And I turned that down. I said, no, this is the book I want to do. I want to tell the real story of what Israel's friends in the West did to Israel over 100 years. And that's the book I wrote.
Well, did you get any help from high officials in Israel, or did you have to ferret out most of this on your own?
No. I mean, it's a lot of the stuff I knew because, look, let's be honest. Everybody in the world spies on Israel. Next to Washington, D.C., the Russians have their second biggest embassy in Israel. Because if you spy in Israel, you can find out what's going on in the rest of the world.
You mean because Israel has a lot of an effective spy network? Is this what you're suggesting?
No, it's just because Israelis are on the cutting edge of high-tech technology. And if you want to learn about weapons development or what's happening next on the Internet, you go to Israel. That's where Microsoft goes.
All right. So, I think certainly a lot of our electronic, I know Google has ties to that, and a lot of our major electronic concerns have offices, large offices over there. We'll be back in just a moment with John Loftus as we discuss the secret war against the Jews, an entirely different slant on what's going on than you can hear through regular channels. Well, John, you go ahead and pick the story up.
Okay. I think that a lot of people don't realize that America's foreign policy in the Middle East is dependent on oil. I mean, for the last half a century at least, the rule has been, whatever we might say about liking the Jews in public, it really is in America's long-term interest to obtain the cheap and consistent supply of oil. The Arabs have it and the Jews don't. It's as simple as that. It's not about bigotry. It's about greed. It's about cheap oil. And, if Moses had turned right and settled in Kuwait, we would have made Israel the 51st state. That's been our State Department's consistent policy towards Israel. That's not the American policy. It's not how the American people feel about Israel. You know, for the same half century, we kept electing congressmen and senators that sent more of our American tax dollars to Israel than any other place in the world, because we knew this was a tiny, fragile, embattled democracy that deserved our support. And Israel has been the seed of democracy in the Middle East. You know, people are arguing, well, you know, the revolutions in Egypt or Tunisia or, Algeria, do they depend on Facebook or Twitter? No. What's happened is Israel has taught the Middle East what democracy looks like. If you take polls of the Arab states bordering Israel and you ask the Arabs what kind of government system they would like to have, they don't choose an American-style constitutional democracy. They don't choose a British-style parliamentary one. They choose an Israeli-style government because they have seen how it works, how fair it is. Isn't that funny? That as much as the Arab media, controlled by the dictators, have railed against the Jews as the boogeyman of the Middle East, the Arab people in the streets say, well, you know, if I had to choose, I would rather be an Arab citizen of Israel than an Arab citizen of my own country. And you know, Dr. Stan, the place where that shows up the most is in Palestine. The real secret of the Palestinian people is if they were allowed to vote on whether their street, their home, their neighborhood were to be part of an independent Palestine or part of Israel.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris John was simply talking about, you know, the success of Israel as a democracy and pointing out that certainly there have been polls taken of, say, the Palestinians living in, the West Bank. And when they are polled and asked if they'd rather have an independent Palestinian state or be citizens of Israel, which they're not, of course, but if they had that choice, they'd choose to be citizens of Israel because the citizens of Israel have it so much better. And certainly with the Arabs who are Palestinian, the Arabs who are Israeli citizens who live in Israel, when they're polled, I mean, the vast majority, I mean, 75% or more, say, you know, well, if I had a choice between an independent Palestinian state or remaining as a citizen of Israel, I would be a citizen of Israel anytime. Certainly there's a small component over there who are creating all sorts of problems, but, I mean, people are so much better off. The Arabs living in Israel are so much better off than the Arabs living in Palestine and under Palestinian or PLO or Hamas control. But you're never going to hear this sort of thing from what I consider the controlled media in the United States. And we've seen these polls as well as John has, so they are valid. Go right ahead, John. I think it's a very important point.
Well, I mean, look at the literacy rate. The literacy rate among Arabs in Israel is 98%, tied for the highest in the Arab world. The number of Arab who hold office in a foreign country is the highest in Israel. Women can run for office in Israel, can vote, and most Arab states deny them that access. The educational level of Arabs in Israel is higher than anywhere else. The longevity, the infant mortality rate, whichever measure you pick, it's higher in Israel. And the funny thing is, the neighboring areas of Gaza and the West Bank, they also have a higher per capita income, a higher birth rate, you know, a lower mortality rate, simply because they are neighbors of Israel. Israel provides free health care to the Palestinians. And Dr. Sand, you don't hear that a lot in the Arab media.
You know, well, there are a lot of things that we don't hear here in the United States that really, where we have freedom of the press. I always like to say, when you own the press, you have the freedom to suppress whatever you want to. And the last thing that people want the average American to realize is that there are many people within the Palestinian state who would much rather be citizens of Israel and certainly do not want to be in conflict with Israel, but they're being manipulated by their leaders. Just as the Israelis are being manipulated by their leaders, and unfortunately we are manipulated by our leaders, if we had free access to information, I feel it would be an entirely different world. But you go ahead.
Well, you know, free access to information is key. When, for example, in the Yom Kippur War, I was a young army officer, and I played a very, very small role in rescuing the State of Israel. Henry Kissinger was determined to force a peace treaty on Israel. He was concerned with the flow of oil. And, you know, as long as the Arabs were happy and the oil flowed, that was it. Kissinger knew that Israel only had a 7-day battle supply of ammunition. And when that battle stock expired, he figured that Israel would be ready to sign any piece of paper that Kissinger put in front of them, you know, no matter how onerous. Now, what Kissinger planned to do was keep it a total secret that the Egyptian and Syrian armies were about to attack the State of Israel. Israel relied on American intelligence to, you know, confirm that these things were going on. And Kissinger told the NSA not to warn Israel. Now, I've confirmed this from several people in the NSA. They knew that the Yom Kippur War was going to take place on Wednesday, and the attack took place on Saturday. Word didn't reach Israel until Saturday morning from an Israeli spy and in Egypt, and they realized what was happening, and all of a sudden Kissinger sent a warning: do not fire the first shot. Wait for the Arabs to strike you, or you won't get American support. Sounds fair, right? Until you realize that Israel needs 16 hours to mobilize their military. Everybody in Israel is a reservist. And with 16 hours, you know, then all the moms and dads drive their kids to the front lines, or they all hitchhike to the front. But Kissinger decided to not warn Israel that a major attack was coming. And when Israel found out on its own, he told them not to do anything, not to prepare. It was idiocy. It was good for his scheme to create a pan-Arab oil treaty, but it was certainly not good for the State of Israel. Now, there was one guy in the White House that saved Israel. It wasn't Richard Nixon at that time. Watergate was going on, and quite frankly, he was pretty drunk most of the nights. It was the White House chief of staff that the night before the attack picked up the phone and he called his Israeli counterparts and warned them what Kissinger was up to. He said there would be no supplies to Israel coming for the 7 days after the war started. Now, Kissinger was a military incompetent. He didn't realize he could just drop supplies on the seventh day and rescue them. By the seventh day, the Israeli forces would have had tremendous casualties. In fact, it got so bad that about 3 or 4 days out, Golda Meir told her best friend that she was going to have to commit suicide because Israel would be overrun and they would roll out the nuclear weapons, you know, to, you know, as a final thing for the State of Israel, to try and scare the Americans, the Russians, into scaring the Egyptians and the Syrians to pulling back. It didn't work. The troops kept coming. Now, what saved the State of Israel was Al Haig. He called his Israeli counterpart, warned what Kissinger was up to, and said that the U.S. government had invented a new top-secret weapon called the TOW missile. And he was going to give the TOW missile to Israel behind Kissinger's back. So on the first day of the Yom Kippur War, an unmarked CIA plane flew 40 Israeli military commanders to a little airstrip in Fort Benning, Georgia. And as it happened, I was the duty officer who was briefed to expect them. My job was to train the Israelis on the TOW missile system. And the TOW missile, you know, this is back in 73, was a really neat little toy, Dr. Stan. It's a shoulder-fired missile that could fly almost 2 miles downwind and would unreel a wire behind it. And as you look through your telescope and followed an enemy tank up and downhill, you could steer the TOW missile up and downhill and follow the enemy tank. And it had a 97% kill ratio. Well, when I told this to the Israeli commanders, they were stunned. And we rushed them through a cram course. And Al Haig stripped every TOW missile we had from the State of Israel, and we shipped it into Israel behind Kissinger's back. Now, this was what turned the tide of war. We thought the Jews would, put the TOW missiles in defensive posture around their cities to save as many lives as possible. And instead, those crazy guys dumped all the TOW missiles at two spots out in the desert, the Mitla and Gita Passes, because Israeli intelligence knew the entire Egyptian tank army was going to come through either one of those two passes. And when they were, the TOW missiles were waiting. It was one of the greatest tank slaughters in military history. And to protect Al Haig, the Israeli government put out a story that the Israeli Air Force had blown up all those hundreds of Egyptian tanks. Well, that was such good shooting, the U.S. government military sent out people to walk the battlefield. But there was a problem. They couldn't find any holes on the tops of the Egyptian tanks. All the Egyptian tanks had been blown up from the side. That was the first combat deployment of the TOW missile. So that's the night that Al Haig and I saved Israel.
Well, that is, of course, a story I'd never heard before.
Well, actually, Al Haig deserves 99% of the credit. The rest of us in the military got the 1%. He was a very courageous guy, and I'm glad that I played a very small part and helping Israel survive the Yom Kippur War.
Well, basically, you know, Chris, the official story that I've heard, you know, is that it was Richard Nixon, because his mother had told him, you know, sometime he would save Israel, that he announced he actually sent the military supplies, I don't know, 4 or 5 days into the war. Yeah, and that is that one of the typical myths that we hear so often?
Yeah, that's one of the urban legends. The actual first plane of supplies didn't reach Israel until day 7, except for the unmarked plane that flew the TOW missiles in. Kissinger had his way, and Golda Meir was screaming. She was saying, "My God, what's going on with the supplies?" Because we had promised to resupply Israel with ammunition and spare aircraft parts. But, and one excuse after another, the headwinds were bad. Oh, we can't fly during the daytime. We don't want the European states to know that we're helping you. No, it was a total sellout of Israel. Al Haig saved Israel.
And, of course, what is really so strange is that Henry Kissinger is at least apparently Jewish. But I believe there is a contingent, myself, within the modern-day Jewry, a small number, admittedly. But they have an intense hatred of Israel, and many of them are in key positions. They have been. And they had no concern whether Israel survived or not. This is pretty one of the problems we have. We have so many people with Jewish names in key positions, but of course their loyalty is not necessary to Israel, totally contrary to so much of what we believe today. And of course, if you read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, I think people would know why. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, John, you go right ahead.
You know, Dr. Stan, there have been so many things that have gone on in the history of Israel that people never understood.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think it really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 316 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
But 100 of them. And, of course, Adolf Hitler passed a law that said no foreigners could own the German corporations. So these major bankers, of course, bought up the Swiss banks, and then the Swiss banks bought up the German banks, and the German banks bought up the corporations, so that Adolf Hitler probably didn't even realize the stranglehold that American bankers and corporations had on German industry, as they actually manufactured the German war machine. And what's really so tragic is it wasn't just before the war they were building the planes, tanks, and trucks that were being used for the military. That as they crushed Eastern Europe, but it was during the war, American CEOs stayed there with the American corporations, and all during the war, they built the planes and tanks and the trucks that were being used to transport the German soldiers so they could kill American soldiers. That is one of the most carefully kept secrets of modern times, John.
It absolutely was. And except from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he was reading the British interceptions. He knew what the American corporations were doing, that some of them were playing ball with both sides of World War II. Roosevelt had planned to have a banker's trial as part of the Nuremberg War Trials. And the banker, hoping that German bankers would point the fingers at their American bankers and say, well, wait a minute, why blame us? These were the guys that set us up. Now, Roosevelt died, and Harry Truman didn't know two things. He didn't know about the atomic bomb, and he didn't know about the banker's trial. And so all of a sudden, all the Wall Street lawyers for the Wall Street robber barons rushed in to surround Truman to help him out. And my first boss at Justice was, in fact, one of the Nuremberg prosecutors at the banker's trial, and he told me, quite frankly, that the trials were fixed. He didn't know how, he didn't know why. So that was my job. And what I found out was that these American corporations had made these major investments and wanted to keep their profits. And so at the end of the war, you know, those more than 100 American officials were captured inside Nazi Germany. And having spent all the war there, and, you know, under American Constitution, anyone who gives aid and comfort to the enemy in time of war has committed treason. And but these guys were never prosecuted because, sad to say, my own agency, the Justice Department, helped the State Department out by hiding them. They took the American traitors and put them in a special camp in the British zone, codenamed Ashcan Dustbin. And then eventually the Justice Department quietly released all the American collaborators with the Third Reich and brought them home.
And I think basically, of course, our government is compartmentalized. And while you were actually assigned in the late 1970s as part of a unit of the Justice Department to track down the Nazi war criminals and those who had helped in these terrible atrocities, other departments of the certainly of the government, State Department, elsewhere, were actually helping the Nazi war criminals, as you point out in your excellent book, The America's Nazi Secret. They were helping them, the people who'd killed 2 million Jews in Byelorussia, helping them to actually come to America, get comfortable jobs, live it out their lives in New Jersey. And that was just so infuriating as I read your book.
You know, it is infuriating. I mean, my dad's generation didn't fight World War II to make America safe for Nazi retirement, but we had a lot of them here. And when, in hindsight, the things we did to Israel, there has never been a war that Israel fought that American intelligence didn't help Israel's Arab enemies. And I had every security clearance in Washington, you know, and my job was to go through the classified files and look for evidence about Nazi war criminals. But the more I studied the Nazis, the more I realized that what I was looking at was money.
Well, obviously, there were people in Washington, D.C. who had no intention, though, after the war, of really prosecuting the vast majority of the Nazis. Oh, there were a few were executed as a result of the Nuremberg trials. Most of them were to prison for a short period of time and released. But what is so amazing is under Operation Paperclip, so many of the Nazi war criminals, vicious ones, were brought to America and given comfortable jobs. And another 50,000 went to South America. These were the worst of the worst Nazis. And with the help of MI6 and the contingent within the Vatican, lived out their lives in comfort in South America. And most Americans have never heard the story. is Dr. Stan. Our guest is John Leftis. And, John, you go right on with the story.
Well, my book, The Secret War Against the Jews, was, you know, part of, I guess, a lifelong series of books that I've written. Every once in a while, I would get permission from the U.S. intelligence community to declassify a little bit more. And last year I got a letter from CIA saying I don't have to submit my books for censorship anymore, and so I rushed a few things out into America's Nazi Secret, got that into print. But probably the book I'm best known for is The Secret War Against the Jews, and that is a history of Western covert operations against Israel to crush the infant state of Israel. And a lot of this goes back to the old days. They never would have been in Israel except for blackmail. What happened is that on Wednesday in 1947, a vote was taken by the Arabs, sort of a test vote, to see if there were enough votes in the UN to separate Palestine into Arab and Jewish states. And the vote passed, but barely. It was nowhere close to the two-thirds majority they would need on Saturday. And if the votes held up, there would be no state of Israel. And so the Zionist intelligence leaders went to Nelson Rockefeller, and they dropped some files on his desk. Now, two things about Nelson Rockefeller. Nelson was one of the heaviest investors in Nazi Germany. And the Zionist had his files. And enough to convict him of treason. This would not have been good for Nelson's political career. Now, the other thing about Nelson Rockefeller is that during World War II, he was the American intelligence chief for Latin America. And the Zionists told Nelson Rockefeller...
Hold that thought, John. We want to get this out. Well, this is Dr. Stan. And, of course, John Loftus had a clearance, top secret clearance. Well, three levels above top secret. That's about as high as you can get. When he worked for the Justice Department, he's been, of course, limited in what he could say until recently when finally he no longer has to check with the CIA when he writes his books. He's written some books. In fact, we're carrying three of them, Unholy Alliance, we have got the Secret War Against the Jews, and America's Nazi Secret. But John is giving this a background of what actually happened as far as the establishment of the state of Palestine. And in 1947, of course, they wanted to take a vote in the United Nations to get permission to split Palestine into two states, one Jewish, one Palestinian. And when the vote was taken, well, there weren't going to be a two-thirds majority, which they needed to get it. And so the Zionists went to Nelson Rockefeller, who was at that time, had something to do with, I believe, South American politics. And anyway, he was certainly had been very influential in America's relationship with South America during the war. Now, Nelson Rockefeller was guilty of treason. He had been collaborating with the Nazis not only before but during the war. And we know from other sources that certainly that the Exxon tankers or Esso oil tankers all during the war were providing the oil for the Nazi submarines that were sinking American ships containing American sailors and American servicemen. I mean, the Rockefellers were totally guilty of treason, and so the Zionists, of course, being as meticulous as they are, they had all the files on Nelson Rockefeller when they went to see him, and they said, "We want the votes. We want enough votes to be sure that Israel will get the votes in the United Nations so we can have Israeli state." And, John, you pick up the story there.
Well, so the Zionists walked into Nelson Rockefeller's office and dropped his Nazi financial files on his desk, enough to convict him of treason, and they told Rockefeller they wanted. In 3 days, Nelson Rockefeller called every nation in Latin America, where he had been the intelligence chief, and told them to change their vote. And between Wednesday and Saturday, every nation in Latin America, except Cuba, did change their vote. They all either voted in favor of the creation of the State of Israel, or they abstained from the ballot, which was just as necessary to reach the two-thirds majority.
But there was a Faustian bargain that Nelson Rockefeller made with the Zionists, and I think that's so important. Basically, of course, we've talked to some of my Jewish friends, and one of them, do you know Barry Shamish?
Well, yes, I do, Barry. Barry's a good guy. But this is a real sad thing where Rockefeller was told, Rockefeller then told the Zionists that he had a price that they would have to pay, that they would have to close their eyes to all the Nazi money and the Nazi war criminals going to South America. And they couldn't chase the Nazi war criminals down there. Rockefeller said, you can have vengeance or you can have a country, but you can't have both. And it was a Faustian bargain. It was a devil's bargain. But, you know, what choice did Ben-Gurion have?
Well, the most interesting is that certainly is some. Barry had heard your story on our programs. He's a frequent guest on our programs as well.
Okay.
And basically, several people were very upset with this and said that couldn't be true. And, you know, because the Jews would never have made that sort of a bargain. And Barry said, I have always wondered why they never tracked down the Nazi war criminals. We got probably close to 50,000 living in South America.
Sure.
He said, can you come up with a better explanation than John Loftus? And the people said, well, no, but we don't want to believe it. He said, look, I have always wondered why it didn't make any sense that Jews knew where they were. They never publicized it. They kept quiet. They obviously had some sort of an agreement. They were not going to track down the Nazi war criminals. He said that helps me to connect some of the dots. So you help Barry Shamish, and he said he sides with you totally. When he heard the story, he said, it's the only thing that makes sense.
Yep, and that's exactly what happened. Actually, there were a few people in Israel that know what happened. Years ago, after I left the government, I had a very elderly Israeli historian. He'd been nominated for the Pulitzer Prize, the Nobel Prize, and he had several bodyguards with him. And he sat and said, yeah, this story is true. And, you know, we had a long talk about it. And for a long time, I'd never told the story because I didn't want to embarrass my Jewish friends. But you know what? It's part of your history. You have to know. I actually wrote a novel about this. It's still in print up in Canada. It's called The Witness Tree. You can't buy it in the U.S. You can't go to Amazon.com. You'll have to go to Amazon.ca for Canada. And the book is called The Witness Tree, and it's a history of Eleanor Dulles. Now, the dialogue is fiction, but the story is fact. It was Eleanor Dulles who was the Zionist spy, and she found out that her brothers were Hitler's bankers, and she stole her brother's files, gave them to the Zionists. That's where the blackmail information came from. And why would you do such a thing? True story. Eleanor Dulles was married to a Jewish guy, and he bore him a son, and he committed suicide under very mysterious circumstances. And Eleanor then came to believe that her brothers, who were Hitler's bankers, had pressured her husband to commit suicide. So that's why she became the most important spy in Israeli history.
Fascinating story. Never heard that before. But certainly the Dulles brothers played a very definite part in actually helping certainly this whole Nazi war movement and helping the American bankers, you know, in their manipulation of what happened. And certainly then John Foster becomes the Secretary of State. Alan Dulles sets up the CIA, and they continue their nefarious activities. And very few people understand how important the Dulles brothers were in shaping the world we live in today. But they were internationalists. Their loyalty, I don't think, was ever to America. I think it was this internationalist dream.
Good point.
Yeah. Go right ahead.
Well, I think, you know, we have to realize that we have multinational corporations like Enron and Exxon and Mobil, and they're not American corporations. They're not loyal to our national interest. They're multinational corporations. short-term profit. So their goal is to crush the American consumers with the highest possible oil prices so they can generate the most oil profits in the shortest possible time.
I think we're seeing that right at the present time where, of course, you know, they cut off the supply of oil, or at least shut down somewhat from Libya, and you know, this has only been going on for about a week, and suddenly the oil prices are spiking here in the United States. Everybody says, oh, it's Gaddafi, it's the oil from Libya. He only supplies about 1% of the oil that we use.
And let me tell you, Dr. Stan, I found out tonight that oil has been flowing, that the Libyan people have taken over the oil terminals, and the oil has resumed flow. There is no shortage of Libyan oil.
But they have to have an excuse, and whenever you have an excuse, you suddenly find the oil price spiking. And I mean, we're talking, you know, oil over $100 a barrel will be soon. I fear it's going to $100, $150 a barrel. And, of course, this is going to devastate the American economy. But other people really don't care about that and all the suffering it's going to bring to people all across America, indeed all across the world. But you go ahead.
You know, it's funny you mention that because the articles that were coming out recently were saying that Algeria will have oil troubles as well, and Algeria and Libya together, oil prices will be over $210 a barrel. And the Algerians realized right away that this was a phony story. And they today repealed all their emergency laws. Their country is totally stable. The oil is flowing.
Well, I'll tell you, John, we had word from some very reliable sources in mid-October, sources which I feel have been quite accurate in the past, that in 4 months... 4 months, that's just about right now, there would be a major conflict in the Middle East, and that oil prices were going up to $150 to $200 a barrel. I do not know if it's true, and you always wonder when you get information, inside information, if you're being fed disinformation, but certainly it looks like it's headed in that direction, and if it comes to pass, then we will assume somebody knew in mid-October exactly what was going to be unfolding today, but that's a different story. I'm fascinated, you know, that your information that the oil is flowing in Libya, but they're not telling the American people that. Oh, no, that's why the price is going up, and that's why the price of your airline tickets is going up, and the price of trucking is going up, and that's why, of course, the already fragile American economy is going to have more and more problems. Go right ahead.
Well, it's a bit of a fraud, and one of the things I wrote about in my book, The Secret War Against the Jews, was during the Carter administration that, you know, the CIA and the State Department and the foreign governments were telling Carter that, you know, Saudi Arabia was running out of oil and that the Russians were going to invade the Middle East and seize the oil. And so what America had to do was lift the price cap on American oil. And Carter smelled a rat. He said, no, instead of lifting the price cap so that oil producers can make more money, we're going to keep the price cap, keep the oil underground in America. We might need it for generations down the road. What we're going to do is conservation. And Carter turned off the lights on the Christmas tree and told everyone in America to conserve energy. And you know what? It absolutely ruined the oil speculators. And when Ronald Reagan became president, suddenly the intelligence agencies changed their minds and said, oh, well, I guess there is no shortage of oil. There's actually a glut of oil. The world was awash in oil, and oil prices plummeted, but only after Reagan was elected. What happened was that the oil companies tried to create an artificial shortage. And all over America, people were standing in lines at gasoline stations to try and put gas in their cars, and it was all a fraud.
Well, I remember so vividly at that time the advertisements on television. Actually, they were cartoons. They were dinosaurs, and it said, you know, there are no more dinosaurs, and that's why our world is running out of oil. And it would show these dinosaurs lumbering through the forest, and, well, all the dinosaurs are gone, and there can't be any more fossil fuels, and I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? I mean, how many dinosaurs does it take, you know, to create a barrel of oil? Or how many barrels of oil can you get from a dinosaur? You know, we're moving, you know, billions of barrels of oil every day. You know, I don't know, I think the way I should, every year, what we use about, right now, I think about, 60 or 70 million barrels of oil. That's an awful lot of dinosaurs, you know. but, you know, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. After all, I was a college graduate. And we knew it was fossil fuel and it came from dead dinosaurs. And they all went over there in Saudi Arabian desert to die. That's where dinosaurs die in Saudi Arabia.
But there aren't any more. In hindsight, it is more than a little suspicious.
Yeah. Well, that time
I live down in Florida now. And, you know, we have all these giant oil rigs in the Gulf of Mexico. And, you know, a lot of these oil fields were drilled out. All the oil was sucked out 10, 20 years ago. We're finding out something interesting. The empty oil wells are starting to refill. And what that teaches us is that the old paradigm of dead dinosaurs in the swamp turning into oil may not be true. It turns out the new wave of thinking, not conclusively established yet, but the new wave says that maybe oil doesn't come from rotting organic fuels. Maybe it comes from deep within the earth, and it works its way up. And that's why the oil wells are refilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Wouldn't that be fun?
Well, because, I mean, that it really is much more logical than fossil fuels.
Sure.
But, you know, when you've been told it's a fossil fuel and you're told over and over again, and, of course, the History Channel tells you all about all the billions of years and all about those dead dinosaurs that died, you know, 50 million years ago. And nobody ever tells you anything different. At least now we've heard the alternative theory, which is much more logical. And I do not believe the dinosaurs are certainly regenerating under the earth. I think the oil fields are filling again from another source. But that's for another program. Let's get back to, of course, what happened as far as the oil situation and then how that applies. The misconceptions during the Carter administration, the misconceptions that were foisted on the gullible American people then, and then what's going on today, and the secret war against the Jews.
Well, they wrote in the secret war against the Jews, Americans were standing in line at the gas pumps over a fraud, that this big scare took place, that the Middle East was running out of oil. And it was a complete farce. In the late 1970s, there was no oil shortage. As soon as Reagan came in, everything mysteriously healed itself. And there was so much oil that oil prices actually dropped. But, you know, what's funny is the American press didn't go back and say, well, wait a minute, why do you tell us something that was so obviously false? And sad to say, the American press does not do a very good job of researching complex stories.
Well, of course, we saw something very similar in the mid-2008 when, of course, the price of oil was going up, and by June, why it looked like it was going to $200 a barrel, it got up to $147 a barrel, and then it precipitously dropped. And the reason it dropped was they had no place else to store oil. They had oil in tankers that were just sitting there. They had every tank in the whole world was full of oil. The world was brimming with oil, and they were driving the price up. It was very, very profitable.
You know, a friend of mine was Bill Clinton's director of CIA. His name is James Woolsey. And James has a very powerful point that if we want to win the global war on terror, if we want to win it, we have to stop buying Arab oil. Because the huge profits that the Arab governments make is what is funding terrorism. If we stop buying Arab oil, terrorism will stop. it'll go broke.
Well, somebody is certainly funding the terrorists. In fact, we hear about these rebel armies in Libya. Wait a minute, rebel armies in Libya advancing on Tripoli? Who's funding the rebel armies in Libya? I mean, they don't develop somebody just overnight. Let's form a rebel army and let's get weapons. And it just doesn't happen that way. Who funded the Egyptian army so that they changed sides and did not support Mubarak? They had a very comfortable life. Who funded the Tunisian army and got them to turn against their leaders? Somebody put up a lot of money for what's going on today. We'll be back in a moment with John Loftus. Well, John, we could go on for hours, but we've only got 3 more minutes, so I'm going to go right ahead and sort of wrap up the program, and we'll continue this some other time. But are there any other major things about the secret war against the Jews, or could we...
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
We carry, and we also carry his book, America's Nazi Secret, which you'll certainly want to read, and we've sold an awful lot of those. And then, of course, you'll want to get his book, Holy Trinity. We have this on order. We're going to be getting it in. And this goes, of course, into the alliance with the Vatican to help smuggle the Nazi war criminals into South America. Does this mean that the Catholic Church as a whole was involved? Of course not. It means that there were certain groups within the Catholic Church were involved, just as there are groups within the so-called Protestant Church and groups certainly within the Jewish religion, what I call the Brotherhood of Darkness. If you haven't, of course, read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, shame on you. Now, we have the two books in stock right now. One, The Secret pardon me, the secret war against the Jews. The second one, America's Nazi Secret. And if you'd ordered the secret war against the Jews, you may want to reorder it. We have the because we put those aside, and we're not quite sure where all of those orders are, but a very important book. And we'll be putting together a four-tape set of these interviews with John. Vitally important for you to understand. If you'd like to get copies of this or some of our other programs with John, we will make them available through Radio Liberty. Now, how do we understand what's really going on today? Well, first of all, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. You are seeing political theater over in the Near East and Middle East today. This is all certainly manipulated. I believe it's manipulated to bring about a radical Islamic state, just as we actually actively work to actually drive Turkey from the pro-Western camp into the East into this radical Islamic camp. And you say, why would they do that? Well, of course, you need to get the interview with Paul Williams, actually the talk he gave. It was in our October conference. You can get that independently, or you can get it as part of the five talks that were given at the October conference. Vitally important information that are available on CD. But Dr. Paul Williams will tell you exactly how the CIA, working with certain subversive elements in Turkey, drove Turkey into the radical Islamic camp. And you say, why would they do that? Why, for the same reason that we financed Adolf Hitler. Why American corporations, not we, but American corporations financed Adolf Hitler, not only before the war, but during the war, if you have not yet. We actually have three books on this subject, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, America's Nazi Secret, and Charles Higham's Trading with the Enemy. You're not supposed to know that all during the war, we were actually helping and financing and building up the Hitler's war machine, because after all, it was the greatest generation. We were fighting for freedom. And no, ladies and gentlemen, wars are never fought for the reason that you're told. You need to hear my talk, Iraq, the Untold Story, and get the documentation. You can get many of the things we talk about in our syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. So the talk is Iraq, the Untold Story, the syllabus, Iraq, the Untold Story. You need to have the information at your fingertips, and if you request, well, we can get you so much information. If you want the pages from Secretary of War Simpson's diary, where he actually talks about how he went to the White House on November 25th, 1941, and the president said, oh, probably we'll have the war by Monday. The Japanese always have a surprise attack. The only question is, how we're going to get into the war and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. This I have the pages. I found them back at the Sterling Library. And when I went through Colonel House's papers, so much fascinating information. And you need to have it. You can also get the letter from Ambassador Dodd to Colonel House asking about why the 100 American corporations were in Germany building up the Hitler's war machine. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. Radioliberty.com. You have to help us get the information out while we can. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, of course, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend William Grigg, who, of course, used to be the former senior editor for the New American Magazine. Now, of course, he writes a daily blog, and he has been a radio talk show host. We hope he'll be back on radio before long, but you can read his articles regularly on his blog or lourockwell.com or so many other excellent sites. William, how are you doing tonight?
Dr. Stan, I'm doing very well. It's always a pleasure to be with you. And I need to explain something very quickly here. I've been having problems with my telephone. There's a possibility that we might have our conversation cut short this evening. I just want to let you know and your listeners know up front that there might be some technical difficulties.
All right. If there are, why, we learn how to roll with the problems. That's one exciting thing about talk radio. You never know what's going to happen. And sometimes, you know, the guest doesn't show up. Because I know you'll always be here, but sometimes there'll be a catastrophe and you can't. So yeah. Then I have to start talking, depending upon people to call. And the problem is, sometimes they don't call. And if you don't think that is a difficult thing when you have nothing prepared and you have to talk for an hour. So if your phone cuts out, we can't get back, why, people will hear a monologue unless they call in. But right now, please hold your calls, because our guest is William Grigg. And William, what are we going to talk about tonight?
We obviously have to address what's going on in Northern Africa and Libya, and also the transparent effort again to shoehorn an instant into an existing template. You might call it the Iraq model. And, of course, every time you have a humanitarian crisis of this sort, every time you have a pretext for a military invasion that would be swaddled in the clothes of humanitarianism, you have to have some kind of an emotional hook on which to hang that campaign. And last night, Anderson Cooper, somebody who's become sort of the go-to guy for stories of this sort, for human interest stories amid catastrophe, provided the news hook. He provided what I call the incubator baby overture to some kind of military action in Iraq, or forgive me, in Libya, following the model that was played out in Iraq, when he interviewed a conveniently anonymous woman by telephone who was speaking from Tripoli inside of her apartment, and she, of course, was terrified by the spectacle of the crackdown against the protests that had been roiling the capital city of Muammar Gaddafi's regime. She was described in the transcript as unidentified female. She said, the problem is if you go outside, they're going to shoot you. This is not protest. You cannot protest. I wish we can protest. This is massacre. And Cooper is saying, I hope you know that people around the world are watching and praying and wanting to do something. I hope you know that. And that, of course, was a setup. That was the pitch. It was a batting practice fastball right down the fat part of the plate, and she knocked it out of the park. This is what she said, according to the transcript. Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Thank you for your efforts, for the scene and effort. Please don't misunderstand me, but the only way something can happen is to put the right kind of action, the right kind of movement, and the first step, make Libya a no-fly zone. If you make Libya a no-fly zone, no more mercenaries can come in. There needs to be action. How much more waiting? How much more watching? How much more people dying? In other words, she's calling for military intervention of the sort, precisely the sort that the neocon war bund here in the United States has been promoting.
And that's exactly what I was thinking. I mean, he's reading the New York Times and said, what can we do while we make Libya a no-fly zone? Well, of course, basically, we know that a lot of the pilots have already certainly defected. Lee Gaddafi's ordered his pilots to certainly attack the civilians who are demonstrating. All this is orchestrated. I mean, does she read the New York Times? No. This is what they want. We'll be right back. Well, what do you mean pick up? You were talking about the woman who's obviously must be reading the New York Times on a regular basis because she's calling for exactly what the New York Times is calling a no-fly zone, similar to what we had in Kurdistan during Saddam Hussein's regime from 1990 to 2003, a no-fly zone, and of course we could have imposed that upon the southern part of Iraq too and saved probably 100,000 lives, during the Iraq invasion there, when we went in to protect Kuwait and restore democracy to Kuwait, which was an authoritarian dictatorship, but that didn't matter. We were told it was a democracy, and that's why our boys were there. We wanted to restore freedom to Kuwait to counter the wicked Saddam Hussein, who, of course, was installed in power a decade and a half before. But basically, of course, we were told, that George W. Bush went on television and said to the people of Iraq, rise up against Saddam Hussein, we'll come and we'll protect you, we'll join with you, help us overthrow Saddam Hussein, and rise up, and we will come to your aid. And so the people of the southern part of Iraq believed the American president, they rose up, and Saddam Hussein set out his helicopter gunships and killed between 50 and 100,000 Shia Muslims there in the southern part. And we did nothing to stop them. We could have declared a no-fly zone. We didn't. We left them there to be slaughtered. And then, of course, afterwards, George Bush said, well, we really had no advantage of going into Iraq. All we wanted to do was, stabilize Kuwait. Well, if that was the case, why did you tell the people to rise up? What you do, of course, would bring retribution from Saddam Hussein. But at least we did keep a no-fly zone in northern part of Iraq and Kurdistan, and it did protect that country so they could survive and prosper during the 1990s. Anyway, go ahead, pick up the story.
Well, not only that, you had in 1995 the spectacle of this UN-created resistance that was conveniently cattle-penned in an area that was immediately accessible to Saddam Hussein's armor, and they were cut to pieces in August to September of that year, and Robert Baer, the CIA operative who was involved in this, was so disgusted by it that he ended up breaking discipline and condemning what had happened. And this is a really good example of what had been called the Budapest rules after the betrayal, the cynical betrayal of the Hungarian freedom fighters in communist-dominated Hungary in 1956. And every once in a while, the powers that be, who are running things here in the United States, will run an enterprise of this sort where they surface the opposition so they can get mowed down.
Well, that thought, of course, William is just simply talking about the fact that during the 1990s, Robert Baer in his book See No Evil describes the fact that the at least two occasions in Iraq, the military was very unhappy with Saddam. They wanted to overthrow him, and they made the mistake of letting the message get out to the American State Department that they were planning a coup to overthrow Saddam Hussein. In both instances, they were betrayed by the American State Department, and the officers were eventually arrested and tortured to death along with their families. And why would the American State Department do everything they could to help Saddam Hussein during the 1990s? In fact, Robert Baer says in his book, and you can get the book, The Radio Liberty, we've kept it because we think it's important, why Robert Baer said he never met an Iraqi citizen who did not believe that the American State Department was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And not only that, but most of them believed that Saddam Hussein, all during the 1990s, was actively working as an agent for the CIA. But they certainly all believed that the American government was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And he cited not one, but two instances where the Iraqi military tried to overthrow Saddam Hussein and were betrayed by the American State Department. These are stories you'll never hear elsewhere, but this comes from an American working for the CIA in Kurdistan in northern Iraq during the 1990s. You pick up the story, William.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what I find interesting as well is that, of course, we get saturation coverage of those atrocity stories, whether real, exaggerated, or entirely contrived, that fit the existing narrative in which the United States acting in concert with its international partners, the multilateral organizations, will saddle up and ride to the rescue of the beleaguered, the besieged, the bloodied in places such as Iraq and Afghanistan and wherever else they want to descend and confer their unique brand of armed humanitarianism on the targets of this rather ironic benevolence. The thing that is happening right now with Libya that I find so striking is the fact that you have this conveniently unidentified female from Tripoli who, in a very plaintive performance, I don't know if she's a really, if she is really a terrified, perfectly independent, innocent person. That's entirely a possible scenario here. Or if you're dealing with somebody who's playing a role, but given Anderson Cooper's background and the way that he has been groomed to be sort of the spokesman for this type of progressive humanitarian outreach, I'm looking at this more cynically than I would otherwise. But the fact that she is reciting the talking points that are being urged upon us right now by the people in the commanding heights of the government-aligned media is something that I find profoundly suspicious when she's asking specifically for a no-fly zone to be imposed on Libya. I find my antennae going up, and I find myself thinking that we're looking at something which is being not only stage-managed, but perhaps even scripted. Right toward the end of this transcript, she's saying the only way we can fix this is if somebody takes action, if you just make Libya a no-fly zone. He's bringing African mercenaries because he has so much money. He can buy people with money. He doesn't care. They go inside to kill us, to rape us, to destroy our country, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, just 2 days before, the former head of the World Bank, Mr. Paul Wolfowitz, of course, was one of the really influential people in the Bush administration, both Bush administrations, really. He's the guy who created, way back in 1992, a model for expanding NATO into the near abroad of the former Soviet Union, absorbing former Warsaw Pact countries and even some elements of what had been sort of Russia's sphere of influence beyond Eastern and Central Europe. And then, of course, in the second Bush administration in the Defense Department, he was more or less the commissar in charge of putting together the occupation of Iraq following the invasion back in 2003. He went on to the World Bank, and he's been all over the media, print media, electronic media, various places from his area there in the American Enterprise Institute. He had a piece talking about the need for precisely what this young lady from Libya was talking about. The international community that is so concerned about the United States acting unilaterally waits 4 days before even holding a meeting of the Security Council, complained Wolfowitz, while the Libyan people cry out desperately for help. And of course, here on Anderson Cooper's show, we hear a desperate cry for help. Multilateral action takes much longer, so it should be organized earlier. The UN Security Council needs to do more today than just pass hortatory resolutions or impose sanctions that will have no immediate effect. And then he says, he shares a couple of heart-rending humanitarian vignettes here, the standard atrocity story fare that has been the staple of war propaganda atrocity porn since at least World War I. Then he says, more public statements or even the imposition of sanctions are of absolutely no use at this point. Much more urgent action is needed. The United States should be seeking UN approval for, let me stop right there, you seek approval from what? You seek approval not from a subordinate, you seek approval from a superior. And every time people start talking about the idea of going to the United Nations for authorization, they're either consciously or subconsciously deferring to the United Nations as if it were a global sovereign of some sort. I don't happen to think that the United Nations, as presently configured, is what it's likely to become at some point after the United States completes the ongoing economic collapse and we find ourselves being reduced to a level of general penury with the rest of the world's population. But it is, among other things, a way for corrupt people in our government, that is to say the government afflicting us, I don't want to say that we are in some sense in charge of it, but the people ruling us use the United Nations to get around the restrictions on their power contained in the Constitution. As imperfect as those restrictions might be, they do provide an impediment to their ambitions, and so they circumvent restrictions, for instance, on the war-making powers by going to the United Nations, because since we got involved in the UN in 1945, there has been, for all intents and purposes, a standing, open-ended declaration of war that supersedes Congress's constitutionally indispensable function of declaring war. Since the UN Participation Act was ratified in 1945, we've never had a declaration of war. And every time we've gotten involved in some foreign excursion, almost in every occasion involving something that has no colorable connection to American interests at all, the United Nations or its affiliates have provided the supposed legitimacy for that undertaking, the first of which, of course, was in Korea in 1950, and that was justified by, among other things, America's involvement in the NATO treaty. Harry Truman had sent troops to Europe under the aegis of NATO without congressional support or congressional ratification, and he said that under the terms of our involvement in the United Nations, I don't need congressional support. I don't need congressional authorization for that. I have standing permission to do this. And then when the United Nations decided to get involved in the Korean conflict, Harry Truman didn't get a declaration of war. He sent troops to Korea before Congress had acted, invoking his then-recent precedent of sending troops to Europe under the aegis of NATO. So he's bootstrapping the second usurpation of the congressional war declaration power on the back of the first, if you will. But that's the sort of thing that's been happening since 1945. So here you have Wolfowitz once again invoking that model, saying that the United States should be seeking UN approval for the following: recognition of a provisional authority in liberated areas, or even a provisional government of free Libya, if the Libyans can organize a credible one, initially in Benghazi in the east and Misrata in the west, which seem to be liberated, although they are still under the threat of attack. Secondly, provision by member countries, including specifically Egypt and Tunisia, of any support requested by these provisional authorities. See how they're bringing these two countries under the umbrella of this embryonic regional UN affiliate? They're basically talking about creating some kind of an Arab equivalent of NATO here to deal with this emergency. Imposition of a NATO-supported no-fly zone over Libya to halt further bombing by Gaddafi's forces. Urgent supply of food and medical supplies to any point in Libya that is accessible by road or by military transport aircraft, provision of arms to the provisional authorities. When there are so many things that could be done to help the unbelievably brave Libyan people without any risk to American lives, it is shameful to be sitting on our hands, said Mr. Wolfowitz, one of the architects of the disaster in Iraq. If that is not reason enough to act, then we should be thinking about the terrible reputation the United States is acquiring by its inaction among the Libyan people and throughout the region. It will stay with us for a long time. That last line, that closing stinger, displays that, if, in case there was any ambiguity on the point, Wolfowitz is biologically incapable of feeling shame, because here is somebody who confected a rationale, helped to confect the rationale to get the United States involved in the first Iraq war. He was a supporter of the sanctions regime that resulted in the starvation and disease-related deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children during the 12 years that this embargo was being enforced on Iraq. He's somebody who supported and helped promote the second invasion of Iraq. He's somebody who put together this provisional regime in Iraq, this occupation mechanism that plundered everybody in every conceivable direction, both in Iraq and elsewhere, in order to make extravagantly wealthy a handful of politically corrupted, politically connected and unfathomably corrupt contractors, while imposing this miserable UN-mandated and U.S.-orchestrated regime on Iraq. And he's talking about our reputation in the region if we don't confer similar benisons on the Libyan people. The reputation of the United States is dismal right now, precisely because of what we have done, not because of anything we're not doing. But the key to this, of course, is the idea that it begins with a no-fly zone. And you have Wolfowitz on the 22nd, just a couple of days ago, talking about these cries for help. And then on Anderson Cooper's show a couple of nights later, what do we hear? A cry for help calling for exactly the same kind of thing, beginning with a no-fly zone, that Mr. Wolfowitz had been talking about. And, of course, has been discussed by his comrades in the American Enterprise Institute and the other neocon organizations.
You know, what really bothers me, if I was living in a totalitarian nation under siege, I certainly would not be talking, you know, long distance to somebody in the United States. Obviously, I would know that all the phones are being tapped, all the international calls are being monitored. How would you find a woman like that? How would you find a woman who is courageous enough to be willing to talk to an American reporter at the risk of her life? One would be calling for exactly the same no-fly zone as Mr. Wolfowitz. go right ahead.
That's a very good point that you made.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think it really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
In these times of falling values, high unemployment, loss of income, and with hyperinflation on its way, we have created a one-ounce silver coin with a cross and the words of John 3:16 on one side and the American Eagle on the other. These coins are mural finished, 0.999 silver. Each of these beautiful coins will always have an earthly store of value, plus the cross with John 3:16 as an eternal value. Go to www.john316coin.com and call 1-877-316-COIN while supplies last. Order these beautiful 1-ounce John 3:16 American Eagle coins today by going to john316coin.com and calling 1-877-316-COIN.
Assets. And certainly William is pointing out that certainly Anderson Cooper, who works for 60 Minutes and did a interview with some woman in Tripoli just a night or two ago, and this woman was just giving the old atrocity stories and then calling for a no-fly zone, certainly over Libya, which of course is not something I think most people even would have thought of, unless maybe they had read it in the New York Times, because that's what they were calling for. But certainly, then of course, William was talking about the fact that when they had the Church Committee hearings on the CIA back in the 1970s, that several people, among them George Herbert Walker Bush, was told the committee, do not bring out the fact that the CIA CIA has people planted in the media. I would point to a book written by Lieutenant General William Odom called Fixing Intelligence. Now, William Odom was certainly the head of NSA and has signed all sorts of security agreements with the promising never to tell what he knows. And he, believe me, is head of the NSA. That's the most secret of all secret agencies. He knows a lot of them, but he's a patriot. So he couldn't tell you what's going on, but he could ask questions. Should the CIA be assassinating people? Should the CIA have journalists planted in the media? Should DARPA be collecting dossiers on American citizens? Now, he didn't say anything. He didn't say these things were going on. He just asked the questions. Should the CIA have a journalist planted in the media? And I think that if you don't read between the lines and pick up the fact that the CIA does have people planted in the media shaping our reality, former ideas, molding our minds, why you're incredibly naive, ladies and gentlemen. And you probably should just quit listening to the media all at all because you wouldn't understand anything that's being said. But go right ahead, William.
Well, that's a very good way of approaching it. Another book that covers much the same information from a different perspective is entitled The Mighty Wurlitzer, How the CIA Played America by a man named, I'm trying to remember his name, Hugh Wilford, I think was the name of that author of that book, The Mighty Wurlitzer. And it talks about, among other things, the role played by a fellow by the name of Frank Wisner. We talked about Frank Wisner Jr. a couple of weeks ago. He was the fellow who was the back channel to Omar Suleiman, the I guess former now vice president in the government of Hosni Mubarak. He was sent by Obama to Egypt, and this is appropriate because his father had been one of the architects of the operations directorate there at the CIA, and he's the guy who actually put together some of the programs that were talked about elusively in the Church Committee report back in the 1970s. The final report, as Bernstein points out here, didn't adequately describe the role played by various newspaper reporters who were controlled by the CIA, and it was very sketchy in dealing with the extent to which the CIA had penetrated the institutions of prestige journalism. And then Bernstein went on to say the CIA even ran a formal training program in the 1950s to teach its agents to be journalists. Intelligence officers were taught to make noises like reporters, explained a high CIA official, and were then placed in major news organizations with help from management. These were the guys who went through the ranks and were told, you're going to be a journalist, the CIA official said. Relatively few of the 400-some relationships described in agency files followed that pattern, however. Most involved persons were already bona fide journalists when they began undertaking tasks for the agency. I suspect that in Anderson Cooper you've got somebody who meets that description. He, according to his biography, was an intern at the CIA. He was interested in going into intelligence, but he decided not to choose that line of work. Rather, he was going to become a journalist. And now, of course, he's a journalist who's got multiple and very interesting connections with the world of intelligence. He's able to pick up a telephone and talk to somebody in the capital city of Tripoli when it's under siege and when the government of Libya is trying to crack down on any kind of communication with the outside world. He's able to talk to somebody on the telephone who happens to repeat the party line being put out by the war party apparatus here in the United States. Please impose a no-fly zone. That's the only thing that's going to work. So I think you're dealing here with something that is probably an act of ventriloquism. You've got the party line being put out in Washington and being repeated by somebody in Tripoli and being broadcast through the mighty Wurlitzer of the CIA media apparatus to the public in anticipation of yet another military crusade that's going to have regional implications and global implications for the economy.
Well, I think that it's important that this could be just a coincidence. I mean, it could be just a coincidence.
Could
that
be.
The day after Mr. Mubarak left Cairo, he fell into a coma. It could be just a coincidence that the day after the dictator of Tunisia left Tunisia, he fell into a coma. It could be just a coincidence that the Shah's son, who would, of course, have been eligible to become the ruler of Iran if the Ahmadinejad regime and the Kabulis were overthrown, he suicided himself there in January. All coincidences.
Let us swear allegiance.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, of course, is William Craig. But, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to start beginning to think objectively. You've got to decide whether you're going to believe what you're told by the CIA-controlled media, or maybe it's not CIA-controlled. I'd like to say the Brotherhood of Darkness controls it, because it is members of the Brotherhood of Darkness that own the media, and, of course, they employ the CIA agents who carry out their directives coming from other branches of the Brotherhood. We do have people who run an invisible government. We have a visible government we elect, made up of senators and congressmen, and they go to the houses of Congress, and they pound the table, and they make speeches, and they give interviews. But we have an invisible government. That, of course, really is running things behind the scenes. Under any circumstances, it could be simply coincidence that Anderson Cooper certainly has this background and has these opportunities for these interviews. We will never know. I'm sure Anderson is not going to tell us, but you go right ahead.
I don't think he'd be anywhere near that candid. It's interesting how they've cultivated him as well. He's somebody who has a certain marketability because he's a striking physical specimen who seems to have sort of a full-spectrum appeal to people who are consumers of celebrity culture because of his background with the Vanderbilt dynasty, and he's somebody who actually worked as a model for a while. So he's very uniquely positioned and very influential in terms of propagating a message of this sort. But I think that it is immensely important to recognize here that if you're dealing with somebody on the ground in Tripoli who's seeing the government falling apart and seeing the chaos and tumult and bloodshed, it seems to me that the last thing that this person would want would be an intervention here when Muammar Gaddafi is losing control of the military. He just executed 150 troops who refused to carry out his orders to fire on the citizens of the Libyan government, or the citizens of the Libyan, the citizens of Libya. You have pilots who are defecting, taking their planes with them rather than opening fire on protesters. And one at least.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly William is talking about what's going on over there in Libya. Apparently, the Navy was ordered to actually to go to one of the cities, not Tripoli, but another city, and fire on the people there because they were rising up. And the Navy, they just didn't carry out the orders.
Mm-hmm.
Soldiers have been ordered to fire on the citizens, and they refused to, and they in turn have been executed. The Air Force has been ordered to fire, take their planes up and fire on the citizens, and a couple of the planes were flown, I think, to Malta, one of the other islands there, and just the pilots just said, we're going to land our planes, we're not going to fire on the Libyan citizens. Gaddafi is losing control, but I think the most significant thing about this story is that if you read the stories, they will tell you the rebel units are advancing on Tripoli. What do you mean, rebel units? I mean, a unit is some sort of a military organization. Oh, yes, there are rebel units, rebel military organizations. Where do they come from?
Yeah.
These are not army units that are advancing on Tripoli. The army doesn't want to fight. They don't want to fight against the citizens. So where do these military units that are advancing on Tripoli come from? They just sort of materialized, and somebody said, hey, I've got a couple of thousand rifles here. I've got all these ammunition and hand grenades and mortars, and we'll just give these to our friends. And ladies and gentlemen, if you believe that, you believe anything. This whole thing is orchestrated just like the Philharmonic Symphony. You're seeing political theater at its best. Before we go on, William, because we get what happens, I get so interested in your remarks that I forget to ask you how people can get to your website, how they can find the material that you provide, and how they can get to your PayPal button.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. My blog is called Pro Libertate. It's found at freedominourtime.blogspot.com, freedominourtime.blogspot.com, or you can go to a search engine of your choice and put in my name, William Grigg, and perhaps Pro Libertate is the second search term, and one of the first returns will most likely be Pro Libertate, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. As mentioned, Dr. Stan, at the end of every essay that I write, there is a PayPal button which people can access if they have the means to contribute and interest in helping keep my blog going. This is how I support my family, and we have a large family. It's a really interesting time to be doing what I do for a living. People ask if I'm working. I say, yeah, I'm working all the time. Earning's a different proposition, but I'm always working. In any case, freedominourtime.blogspot.com is the blog. I also post material very frequently at lourockwell.com. The redoubtable Mr. Rockwell is the president of the Ludwig von Mises Institute, which I consider to be an organization that is indispensable in terms of promoting genuine free market capitalism and minimal government, as minimal as you can imagine. Mr. Rockwell's blog is Lou Rockwell, that's lewrockwell.com. That's actually his website. It also has a blog which is found on the right-hand side of every page, and I frequently contribute items on the blog at lewrockwell.com, and lewrockwell.com also republishes a lot of what I write, publish at Pro Libertate, which is longer-form journalism, generally between 1,800, 2,200 words in length. Most of my essays are not the typical fare you'll find on most blogs. They're not brief reviews or palimpsests of things that have been written by other people. What I try to do is investigative blogging, if you will. And there are a number of people who do that kind of work, and it's something I greatly enjoy. Once again, Pro Libertate is the blog. LouRockwell.com is another place where you can find my material. And I'm getting into the habit now of distributing podcasts, audio podcasts, in anticipation of getting my radio show back up and running. I'm starting to do audio podcasts as well. And this is something that is in its shakedown phase. But if your listeners have access to Facebook, they can friend me on Facebook, and then I can get in touch with them and send them my audio podcasts, which I'll be sending out probably at the rate of two or three a week.
Well, you know, if you would like to actually take down our weekly interviews and actually put those up on your website or send those out as podcasts, you do not have to ask my permission. Just
I really appreciate
do that. And
this
might, you might even be able to get people to be willing to contribute on a regular basis, that they would be able to pull those down. Something that, so anyway, you have to find all sorts of means to survive in the current environment. But is it there is a PayPal button at the bottom of William's pages there, and certainly I would consider it something I would like to see people help. Keep him going. He is one of the most important sources of information commentary we have. So put a plug in for your PayPal, and then we'll get back to what's going on over there.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. The PayPal button, once again, at the bottom of every essay at Pro Libertate, which is at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And I do appreciate your help, Dr. Stan. I'm very grateful to your audience as well. And I have to say that I suspect that my telephone is about to cut out. Just by way of a warning here, we might be cut off in just a second. But in any case, thank you so much, Dr. Stan, for allowing me to make that pitch. And thank you for everything that you and your listeners have done for me and my family.
I think we just lost our guest this evening, so if you'd like to, I don't know whether they're going to be able to get him back on again. So if you have out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, here in the Central Coast of California. And this is that terrible time that a talk show host has, and suddenly he has no guest. And he can't have dead air, so he's got to be able to try to find something worthwhile to say. What I really think you have to understand is that this whole uprising in the Near East and the Middle East has been anticipated and planned. And certainly, those of you who listen to our programs regularly won't remember that certainly it was the 1st of November when we had Lindsay Williams on, telling us that he had been told was going to happen. Now, basically, of course, I lived through this. We keep careful records on this. It was about 2 weeks before the 1st of November. That would mean the middle of October. Why, of course, Lindsay had talked to Ken Fromm. Ken Fromm was the CEO of ARCO when he retired. He was pretty close to the top of the Brotherhood of Darkness. He was certainly not probably one of the inner circle, but he had a pretty good idea what their plans were. That subsequently ARCO was bought up by British Petroleum. So British Petroleum bought up ARCO, but certainly Ken Fromm had been told the middle of I think it was June of 2008, to call Lindsay Williams and tell Lindsay, you will stop talking about the oil off the North Slope of Alaska. Why? Well, because they were, of course, planning on running the cost price of oil up to astronomical levels as part of toppling the economy of our country. Now, they were planning at that time to run the price of oil up, and it was hovering about $137, $138, and certainly I, Lindsay, most people at that time, felt that, of course, the price of oil was going to go to $200 a barrel. But, of course, after, first of all, Mr. Fromm, who knew Lindsay very well. They'd been very, very close for many years. For several years after Ken Fromm was fired, because, of course, he had let Lindsay know about this massive oil field off the North Slope of Alaska. And, in fact, Ken Fromm had even written several chapters in Lindsay's book, The Energy Non-Crisis, and certainly it clarified many of the things that Lindsay, who was a missionary, he didn't understand the oil business, but Ken Fromm did. Well, anyway, Ken Fromm had created so much of a stir, and they either had two choices. They had to kill him or give him his job back. So Ken Fromm was then reemployed by ARCO, continued up to the ranks until he became the CEO. But he called Lindsay at that time, and this would be probably in the early 1980s, and said, Lindsay, I can't talk to you anymore. I've been certainly rehired by ARCO. I will not be talking to you again. And then of course, Lindsay didn't hear from Ken Fromm. I know from the early 1980s until he was contacted in 2008 and told, you, this is what will happen to you. This is what will happen to your family. You will, first of all, take down your website. You will stop talking under any circumstances, doing radio programs about the massive amounts of oil off the North Slope of Alaska, because we can't let the American people know that there's plenty of oil. And third is that you will pull your book, The Energy Non-Crisis, off of Amazon, which, of course, Lindsay, being a man who may be certainly very concerned about goings-on, but he's not crazy. And when you get an offer from a request from these people who run the world, why you do not challenge them anymore? The Mr. Mubarak challenged the people who, when he was told to leave Egypt, any more than the dictator of Tunisia challenged when he was told to leave Tunisia, any more than Batista challenged when he was told to leave Cuba back in 1959. I know that firsthand because I have an interview with Earl Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba in 1959, and you could see that interview in my DVD, The World Revolution, which is available at 1-800-544-8927. And of course, Earl Smith, who was a billionaire, he was the American ambassador to Cuba at that time, told me personally that he was ordered by the State Department to go to the duly elected president of Cuba, Batista. He was democratically elected, contrary to everything you hear. But he was democratically elected. He may have been autocratic, but he was still was elected and should have stayed in office for another 6 months. But he was told by and ordered by the American government, you will leave Cuba tomorrow, which, of course, how we turned Cuba over to Fidel Castro, who was a known communist, had probably been working with the CIA for many years. Because, of course, the CIA and communism are interchangeable, the best enemy money could buy. I mean, who do you think funds communism since its inception? But that's getting so difficult for people to believe, that we would actually fund and help communism. But you have to have an enemy. If you don't have an enemy, how can you rally the people behind the government? That's what we did during the Second World War with the Nazis. We financed the Nazis. not only before but during the war, so that we could have an enemy, so all those boys could die. But then, of course, the hope was it would lead to the one world government. When it didn't, we ensured there was going to be a third world war, and that was what I think is imminent and is coming. How soon, I don't know, but I believe it is coming. Then you're going to need a terrible, terrible war to make the people of America be willing to give up their freedom and willing to go into this one world government. Well, under any circumstances, I think this is exactly what we are witnessing today. I think we are witnessing the preparation for driving the whole of the Islamic world into this radical form of Islam. You hear the talk, oh, this is about democracy. This is about the people being oppressed. Oh, this is brought about by Al-Jazeera, the radical Islamic television network, which is broadcasting into the homes of the people over there and, of course, encouraging the revolution. Ladies and gentlemen, Al-Jazeera was formed by MI6 at British Intelligence. In fact, in the year 2004, it was situated in London. Why would the radical Islamic television network be situated in London? Why? Because this whole radical Islamic movement has been funded by MI6 and by the CIA and by other Western sources since its inception. After all, you can't have a war unless you have an enemy. And if you haven't read the book, The Devil's Game, it's well worthwhile getting. It will give you a lot of information you won't get elsewhere. Of course, the book's contention is why the intelligence agencies funded and created Hamas. They funded and created the Muslim Brotherhood. But it was a Frankenstein that got loose, and I would like to suggest they created a Frankenstein, but that Frankenstein is doing exactly what they wanted. And all you need to do is just look in the background of so many things that have happened. I don't know how many of you are acquainted with the story of the 7/7 bombing. That was the bombing over in London where they blew up a subway train, they blew up a bus, and of course there were these four radical Muslims who had been taken over to Pakistan, had been trained there by a young man. And the young man, of course, was not killed that day. The problem with this whole story is, if you look at the floor of the trains, instead of the metal of the floor being blown downward by the explosives carried by these Muslims, the floor was blown upward as if the explosives were below the floor, not in the knapsacks as we've been told, but the man who trained them. And you can check this out on the internet just this last week. The man who trained them and told them how to build the bombs and provided the explosives for the bombing of the subway and the bus there in London had to kill, I don't know, 20 or 30 people. How many people were injured? The man who trained them and admitted he trained them, after 4.5 years of, well, we don't know where he spent the 4.5 years. Maybe he spent it at one of the exclusive London hotels drinking martinis. But after 4.5 years of imprisonment, he pleaded guilty. I did it, I trained these people. Why, he was fined $500 and let go. Now, what's wrong with that story? I mean, does that sound like this is... the prosecutor said he was just so helpful, we felt we ought to let him go. It's like the Lockerbie bomber, you know, who blew up the Pan Am 103 and killed over 200 people. And he was, of course, convicted in Scotland of this terrible and heinous crime of bringing down a plane and killing well over 200 people. And after 7 years of imprisonment, this vicious bomber, because he was dying of cancer of the prostate, he was released on a compassionate release, returned to Libya, and miraculously his health has been improving ever since then. What's wrong with this picture? He only had 6 months to live when he was released 2 years ago, and he's getting healthier and healthier all the time. Do you really believe those stories? And the thing is, reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. Go up on the internet, look up the story of Ali Muhammad. There's several stories there on him, several Wikipedia stories. One suggests many people think that he was actually always a CIA asset. He was the man who planned the bombings there and of the embassies in Tanzania and Kenya that killed well over 100, injured over 5,000. He was the man who participated in the first World Trade Center bombing. He was the man who trained Osama bin Laden's bodyguards. And, of course, we don't know where he's incarcerated. Nobody knows where he's incarcerated. He just pleaded guilty, and just nobody knows where he is. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and there's so many unknowns out there. And I was just talking about the story of Ali Muhammad. And
heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze-dry guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.